Okay. Welcome to the Hacking State podcast. This is your host, Alex Mershak. With me today is Professor Stephen Hicks. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alex. Good to be here.
Thank you. Thank you for coming on. So, you and I actually spoke on my last show. Some of the listeners might remember Agora Politics. We discussed at the time your book on postmodernism. But today we're going to get into a totally different topic. Which is in some ways almost antithetical to the topic of our last discussion, which is Ayn Rand, and especially her philosophy of objectivism. Now you have been involved with this work for quite a long time, and so I just wanted to ask you, how did you first stumble into Rand, and what first attracted you to her?
Well, I first came across her due to my parents. They were readers and they had a good library. And so I remember seeing her books on their bookshelf. And when I was a young kid, asking my mother, about Atlas Shrugged, this big fat magnum opus book. And she said, "Oh, that's a really good book. You should read that, but when you're a little bit older." So I just filed it away. And so I ended up reading Rand in, I had what we now call a gap year between high school and university. So I started reading over that year, and I read The Fountainhead first and loved it. That was the summer before I started university. Then I read Atlas Shrugged, and it was great. And I was gripped by both the storytelling. She's a really a great novelist in the stylized romantic tradition. But at the same time, what makes her powerful is that she is a philosophical novelist. So the characters and the plot are driven by philosophical themes. And so I found myself engaged with those. And simultaneously, I was taking my first year of university courses in philosophy and politics or political theory in the usual range. So it was kind of a good intellectual wake-up year, as I think of it, where I conceptualize what philosophy is as a discipline, and loved it. So, to the second part of the question, though, is about what attracted me to Rand, and I think I had the experience that a lot of people had, was that when I read Rand, that she put in words clearly things that I had sort of been thinking already. So, in part, this is the idea that your life should matter and that you should take it seriously and that you should live a principled life and set high goals for yourself. But at the same time, when you're a thoughtful, sensitive teenager, you start to realize that there are lots of people who are liars and hypocritical in their speech and already have given up on their dreams and their goals, and are nonetheless envious of people who have dreams and goals, and would be willing to do things to tear them down, to backstab, to be passive aggressive, all of these things now in our vocabulary. And in many cases, when you're a teenager, that kind of person is bewildering to you. Why are they that way? And so then being able to figure out not only what it goes to start thinking for yourself and putting together a principled, big picture, adventuresome sense of what your life can be, but also giving you the understanding and the tools to deal with the backstabbers and the hypocrites and the deeply envious people. So all of that was what initially attracted me to Rand.
Yeah, I had a similar experience, maybe not quite as young, but I did read Atlas Shrugged. I'm sorry, not Atlas Shrugged. I read The Fountainhead in college. And at the time, it had a remarkable impact on me. I didn't go a lot deeper into, some of her like philosophical works, objectivism itself. But you're right, it is a kind of like philosophical they're philosophical novels, and you get a lot of the philosophy embedded in the storyline and the interactions between the characters and especially the protagonists. For a young person, it does there's something about reading it around that age, early adulthood, late adolescence, that does tend to stick with people. I've almost encountered no one that is a that are acolytes of Rand who didn't discover her around that period. And so there is something about the ambition and the openness and the desire to make a name for yourself at that age, especially, that I think really makes Rand resonate for a lot of
Yeah,
people.
for
And
sure. Yeah.
it's a good find because, you know, it's probably, I don't know if it was worse when you were in school, but you know, certainly by the time that I was in school, you were surrounded by all this, you know, what Nietzsche would call like raisonnement, right? A lot of philosophies, a lot of doctrines that were built around really resenting the success of others or resenting people, groups, ideas that had been more successful. And
Yes.
so in some ways it's a useful anecdote, sorry, antidote for that. But it does have this radical individualism that I think is also particular to American culture. Do you think that there's and Rand's books were obviously tremendously popular in her own time. Do you think there's something particularly American about these ideas?
Well, that's an interesting question. Partly because America now, for the last century or so, does have the international reputation for being the most individualistic culture. And I think there is a lot of sociological and historical truth to that. You know, in part, America was a new country, it was able to start. Without the baggage that many countries in Asia, Africa, Europe even had. So they were able to start tabula rasa to a large extent. And at that time, it was Enlightenment ideas, particularly British Enlightenment, although some French Enlightenment also, that came across to North America. And also the people who were coming to North America, the immigrants. They were, you know, self-starters. They're the kind of people who can pick up and go halfway across the world and start their lives over. So there was a very nice mix historically, right, of people who made America and then built it into a dynamic success. So I think then from the perspective of Europe, if we just start with Europe, there is something uniquely special about America, not necessarily that they agree, but they recognize that something is going on there. At the same time, I don't want to underplay how radically individualistic Europe had started to become in the 1400s with the rise of the Renaissance, the rediscovery of many Greek and Roman texts. So I would say if we want to take a longer view, that the seeds of the individualism were planted in Europe. And you started to see it in the artistic culture of the 1400s and 1500s, you know, fiercely individualistic people like Michelangelo and Leonardo. You did see it in many of the early scientists, you know, that I'm going to think for myself. I'm not going to rely on old dogmas and old traditions. And I'm willing to stand up to those because of the judgment of my own reason. I've got the evidence, I've got the logic, I've got the math. So, in the arts, in the sciences, the fierce individualism that started to occur in religious circles with the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, that I'm going to take charge of my own soul and what I think. Is true religiously. I am willing to fight for it, often nastily. So this was a brutal time, but the individualism was there. So all of the seeds of individualism in art, in science, in religion, and in other areas of life, that is what was generalized in the 1700s when the United States was being founded, and to a significant extent in Canada. In other parts where British culture was expanded around the world and other parts of Western Europe as well. So I think it's fair to say that those ideas were born in Europe, particularly in Western Europe, particularly in Northwestern Europe. I should also give some plugs to the Dutch at this point as well. But then because of the fertile soil and the new countries, the new cultures in North America, that it really flowered, it took root. mixing the metaphors or reversing the metaphor there in America, and really took off at an accelerated rate, and then more slowly in other parts of the world, cultures became more individualistic in the 1900s on into now the 2000s, spread to Asia, spread to parts of Africa, and so on.
And so you see Rand then as one part of this long lineage of the spread of individualism, sort of from the Renaissance onward.
Yes, so in that sense, Rand is continuing and in some cases deepening the tradition, because she does have some innovations in her philosophy when she works them out. But then also, I think just in her sense of life, you know, this strong romantic sense of your life as an adventure, all of the romanticism that also had started to flower late 1700s, early 1800s. She's taking that tradition and augmenting it in her own unique style. So I would say she is both a broadening and an extension of those trends.
If you would allow me to address the romanticism briefly, which is that one common criticism of Ayn's work, especially her fiction, is that it's too exaggerated or that it's too black and white. People that want to criticize it as a literary work will say that the characters are almost lacking in complexity, or they want characters that can't be seen as positive models. There's a kind of cynicism that seeps into literary criticism that says that the distinctions between the sympathetic and the unsympathetic characters are too stark in Rand. And this is itself a kind of really a criticism of a romantic style. And so I wanted to ask you what you think about that criticism and also the polemic nature of the narratives.
No, that's a good rich question. I think part of the question is philosophical. And part of the question is artistic, or in this particular case, literary artistic. And so there is a generic criticism of romanticism that it is about high principle and high passion and life as a high drama. And so there are people for whom aesthetically that's just a non-starter. They don't think of their lives that way. They don't want to spend their artistic time listening to music or reading books or movies that are in that genre. And then that antagonism is going to be stressed, especially in the case of someone like Rand, who is very much a high romantic in her literary approach. But the philosophical part, I think, is also important, because there are people, and this is one of the big controversies about whether there are such things as black and white moral principles. So, is it the case that there is good and there is bad? And in some cases, the bad is actually evil. It's self-consciously bad and it knows what it is doing and it is intentionally trying to destroy. And sometimes it's successful. And then on the other side, is there such a thing as clear-cut good principle and people who have strong integrity and commitment who are going to follow through or not? So, first you would have to sort out that philosophical issue, and then there is going to be the big divide there. But what we can expect, though, is that people who think, you know, I want to know what the good is, what is true, what is beautiful, what is noble, what is important, and dedicate my life to that, independently of whatever my artistic choices are going to be, versus those who want to say, no, everything is murky, everything is gray, everything is fuzzy, and I'm just going to kind of go along with the flow in my life. That's going to be one philosophical divide right there, and that does need to be sorted out. At the same time, there are going to be people who know that there is a distinction between good and evil, and they recognize that some things are in fact good, but for whatever reason, they have betrayed that in themselves. There are people who think of themselves as failures in various respects, who are, as you suggested earlier, resentful They are not themselves going to strive for what they know to be good. And they kind of don't like themselves for that. But at the same time, people who are have not given up, who are striving for the good, who display integrity and honesty and a principledness, those people are going to be hated philosophically and attacked and subverted and undermined. So all of that is a philosophical set of issues with an accompanying social dynamic. Now then, if you turn to the literary expression of all of that, what art does by its nature is stylize various things of all of the different, say, kinds of human beings. What the artist does is to say, I think this is important. This is what I want to focus on. I want to spend 6 months doing a portrait of this person and not that person. And I want to stylize the person and present, since I can't portray the whole person, this as the important essential part of who this person is and not these various ones. So there's the stylization that goes on in art all of the time. And that is revelatory of what the artist thinks is important and valuable. But because of the stylization, it is an exaggeration. It's an emphasis. People who philosophically are antithetical to that thing being that is being stylized, their reaction is going to be then more exaggerated as well. So, for example, there's a common theme that we have. If we just talk about movies, there are people who will say, "I hate happy endings in movies, and I refuse to watch any movie that has a happy ending." Now, that's a very strong statement because what's built into that is the idea that I don't want to spend 2 or 3 hours where the person has conflict and then because of their character or their resourcefulness or their perseverance, they rise above the conflict and they achieve success. That just sticks in my craw. I don't believe that. I don't want to try to experience that emotionally. So I go on the offensive against that approach to life. And then, of course, it's stylized intensely if the film is done very, very well. That the kind of person who says, no, I do want to spend time with movies where, and I'm going to exaggerate the other way, where people aren't quite clear what they're doing, things happen to them and against them, and we all muddle through and we're all kind of depressed. And then the main character commits suicide at the end. And I feel a kind of resonance to that. That's what life feels like to me. So you would expect that the anti-romantic sense of life is going to be in deep conflict with a romantic sense of life. So all of that is going to come out in spades when people interact with Rand. They're going to disagree, some of them, with her philosophically, or find themselves in deep agreement with her philosophically right off the bat. And then, if they are dealing with the stylizations of people who are heroic or trying to be heroic and pointing out that some people are, in fact, evil and stylizing the evil to make it very clear and to put it in conflict with the good, some people will respond to that very positively and others negatively. So I think that's built into the nature of philosophy, because in philosophy, we are stressing the important issues about truth and goodness or not. And in art, even more so, we are trying to dramatize those issues. So I think it's just part of the territory that you're going to get into if you decide to be a philosopher novelist of Rand's sort. Now, that's all just to pick up kind of half of the question that you put out. So let me kick it back to you. We can drill down into whether the characters are too black and white or complex enough or not, and then some of the other sub-issues that were there.
So that was a really good breakdown of sort of how the work polarizes, I guess, around people's own personal aesthetic and then philosophical preferences. It does strike me that I would say polarizing is the right word because you get strong reactions almost invariably to Rand. There's people that really dislike her, and if you bring her up, they will act like you're a kook. And others who are overly enthusiastic and maybe even integrate some of her philosophy more deeply into their lives and public identity. And so it, I don't know, it seems to me as if the, I mean, I've only read The Fountainhead, so I'm not familiar with her entire cast of characters, how they're all presented. But I will say that it seems to me as if it's the social dynamic that you said was attendant to this, in terms of the characters, their own, representation of either side of this polar dynamic, strikes me at least, and I think more people even today, as almost prescient in terms of its confluence, or sorry, no, reflection in everyday life, and the development of, I'd say, American culture, unfortunately, over the last 100 years or so, which is interesting to think about, because in a way, the exaggeration, the exaggerated nature that it's criticized for is actually the it's really the just a kind of the logical conclusion of the dynamic that she's setting up for you. So
Right. Yeah, that's nicely said.
if it progresses forward in that fashion, and some would argue that it has, then it's no surprise that in the future it seems very prescient, from when it was written, because it's just unfolding from the principles.
Yes, no, that's nicely said. Sometimes, so 50 years ago when Rand was writing, she would have characters who would embody, so to speak, a certain principle or a certain value set. And then Rand would then have that character be a stylized, consistent, clear representation of that principle and value set. And then she would say, how would this individual act in life? And then they were making predictions about how that principle, and then in some cases, inventing particulars about how that person would act in order to illustrate that. And then if that person, say, has political power, what kind of laws that person would try to enact or would enact if they had political power. And then the reputation that she's developed for prescience, right, comes out of that, so that 50 or 60 years ago now, she was then able to say, well, this is the sort of law or the sort of social dynamic that would happen if we had a large number of people who consistently believed in these principles and had this kind of a character set. And then we start to see in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, exactly those kinds of laws being articulated by certain sorts of people. And in part, that is the power of philosophy, that once you identify a principle and you use that principle to predict people's behavior or more broadly social patterns, if you get the philosophical principle correct, it will be useful to you in doing exactly that. For the same reason that science is extraordinarily powerful. Once we observe a significant amount of nature in action and we run the experiments, and then we are able to generalize to a law of nature or a certain principle about how nature works, it becomes useful to us in predicting the future course of nature. So philosophy in the social aspect of that, once we figure out human psychology, human value set, human social dynamics, if we get it right, then it will help enable us to predict. And Rand was definitely a master at that.
So I wanted to ask you, now, something that connects very directly both her philosophical work and her fiction, which is the relationship between altruism and selfishness. And this is something that is often, again, I would say, misunderstood by her critics, or taken in a straw man kind of way. But I wanted to just ask you, first, how you conceptualize the relationship between altruism and selfishness in Rand's work, and then I have some follow-up questions about that.
Yeah, no, that's a good one, and that's obviously a deep question in philosophy and a standard issue in discussing Rand. Now, one of the standard things that comes up, though, in philosophical discussion is that philosophers will use terms in a technical way, but that by the time we get out to the general discussion, terms are used more loosely. So if you think right now of all of the debates and discussions we have about what's a conservative, what's a liberal, what's a fascist, who's a racist, and so on, all of those terms can and should be defined precisely. But they often are defined loosely, and people are using the same term to mean different things. Or a concept like pragmatism, for example, which sometimes just means being practical, but then pragmatism to philosophers is a particular thesis about what it means to be practical. Now, the terms selfishness and altruism are also loosely used in the culture to mean opposite things. Even people mean different things by altruism. They mean different things by selfish. So if you just kind of journalistically go out and ask, what does being selfish mean? And then you'll find lots of people saying, I think people should be more selfish. Little girls, when their fathers and mothers are trying to tell them they just need to marry the boy next door and not go to college and start making babies, that little girls need to be more selfish. Right, and stand up for themselves and figure out what they want. We all know what that means. At the same time, some people, when you look at it journalistically, will say he's being selfish. What they mean is that you are taking something that you think is good for you and pursuing it in a way that is damaging to the legitimate interests of other people. And those are two very different meanings of the word selfish. And it's the first thing is just to say they are both out there. That's journalistically. The same thing happens on the altruistic side. You'll find some people will say altruism just means, taking into account other people and their interests and being nice and caring in a general way toward toward other people. And that's fine journalistically. That is in fact out there. But then lots of other people will use altruism more systematically, that you are altruistic if you are being nice toward other people in a self-sacrificing way, and you're doing things for other people that are against your own interests, and it's the mark of being altruistic if, in fact, it does involve a cost or a sacrifice that you don't expect to recoup. And those are different meanings of altruism, and they are, in fact, out there as well. So the first thing is, and this is always going to be the sign of someone who's a serious intellectual about these matters, is defining your terms. And when you are dealing with someone you know is a philosopher or an intellectual, to ask yourself, how is this person using this term? Because we know different philosophers and different intellectuals also will use terms in different ways. So what Rand is doing as a good philosopher, and she goes out of her way to do so, is to say, this is what I mean when I am using a term like selfish, or a term like altruist, and she is giving philosophers definitions of those. So if we were to take, for example, altruism, so we'll start with that side of the equation. What she does quite accurately is to say this term philosophically, right, came into the literature and was coined by Auguste Comte, a 19th century philosopher and sociologist. And what did he mean by altruism? Well, he took the term alter, which is originally the Latin for other. And then he said, otherism. And then what do we mean as philosophers anytime we say we add the prefix ism to something? Well, what we mean is to say this is an explicitly self-conscious set of principles that we are operating on. So when we are doing ethics, when we're deciding what's true or sorry, what's true in the area of ethics, what's important, what is your top principle? And Auguste Comte is saying otherism. The most important thing in ethics, the top value is others. And you should live your life according to others, serving others. And he goes out of his way to be explicitly saying this should involve not thinking about yourself, being willing to sacrifice yourself, being selfless in a literal sense. The self is of less importance than others. So that's what altruism has meant in the philosophical literature. It doesn't just mean being nice to other people, sharing your toys with people you care about, being respectful of their rights, and so forth. It's a heavy-duty principled philosophical view in ethics. And then she goes on to argue that there's a long philosophical history of here as well in ethics of philosophers who say you should not think about yourself, you should sacrifice yourself to various others. And sometimes, you know, it's a sacrifice yourself to God, sacrifice yourself to the king. Girls and should sacrifice themselves to their husbands when they grow up and become married and be servants of their husbands and so on. So that's that side of the equation. Now, the other side of the equation is the term selfish. And so Rand does the same thing there. She says, all right, well, let's break this down. Selfish. So what I'm saying is that's to be concerned with yourself and to put yourself's interests first. And basically to say, my life is mine, the pursuit of my happiness is mine. And the same thing is true of you. Your life is yours, and your pursuit of your interests and your ultimate happiness is the most important thing. And that's what I mean by selfish. But then she also points out that before you can say what selfish means, you do have to have an understanding of what the self is. What is your view of the self? And then we run into another big philosophical disagreement because some people have optimistic understandings of the self. What is it to be? What is yourself? Well, myself is my body and my mind, and it means that I should think for myself firsthand, decide what's true and important. I should take responsibility for myself and see that I'm supposed to produce and create the values that my life is going to, right? That I'm going to be self-responsible, self-initiating, self-thinking, and recognizing that you also have a self, that you should be doing the same thing. You should think for yourself and decide your own values and take responsibility for them, and so on. So that's a more optimistic understanding of what it is to be a self. And so her selfishness falls out of that understanding of human nature or of the self. But what other people will do, of course, is then say, no, when I think of what the self is, I think the self is this kind of nasty bundle of aggressive instincts that I want to lie and cheat and just get away with stuff and be lazy. And that's what it is to be a self. So that's my view of what it is to be a self. So when Rand says, be selfish, oh, she must mean indulging in lying and cheating and stealing and trying to get away with it as much as you possibly can. And that's just bad. But that's just right, sloppy thinking. So the first thing I would say is selfish versus altruist, get the terminology sorted out in a philosophical way before plunging into the more substantive debates over them.
Sure. So we've now set out definitions for the terms and
Yes.
Rand's understanding of the self. And so we have a platform on which we can actually have a genuine discussion about the relationship between altruism and selfishness, because we both know that we're talking about the same thing.
Okay, good.
So what I found interesting was that it seems to me from my recollection of Rand is that the relationship between selfishness and altruism is reminiscent of something that I remember from my political theory courses that comes up in Tocqueville. So de Tocqueville talks about self-interest properly understood. And this concept was stressed a lot during it among a number of my professors who wanted to iterate over and over again that there was a kind of self-interest that, if properly understood, lended itself to a kind of what you could call altruism, or what you would say is for the benefit of others, and that these ideas were not therefore necessarily antithetical. And my understanding of Rand, and her philosophical position on this is that it seems to rhyme very or be very close to de Tocqueville's conception of self-interest properly understood. That is, your selfishness, if taken in the right direction, is incidentally, or maybe even purposely, beneficial to others. And it really comes out of this whole positive sum idea that what is good for you can be good to others, will be good to others if you have it calibrated properly.
Yes. So that's to raise then another very subtle issue. And you're right to talk about the lineage. And in the modern world, starting in the early modern world, you do start to see the working out of the territory of self-interest rightly understood, or a more positive understanding of what the self is, and a more harmonious, mutually beneficial understanding of social relations that is possible. So, self-interest, rightly understood prior to the modern world, meant seeing yourself as a sinful creature with all of these nasty, dark desires. And so, self-interest was something that had to be suppressed so that we could get along with each other minimally in society. And as a more benevolent, optimistic understanding of human nature developed in the modern world through I would say, people like Michelangelo, John Locke, Jefferson, and then, as you're pointing out quite rightly, in the 19th century with Tocqueville, the idea of a more beneficial set of social relations came to be at least a big contender. So you use the positive sum language and the zero sum language as well, and that's a nice way of capturing the social aspect of it. So, what is the relationship between me and you? And one of the fundamental drivers is whether you have an optimistic or a pessimistic understanding of human nature. So, if you, for example, think that human relations are zero sum, and pretty much the entire, for example, socialist tradition wants to say that they are. So that if someone gets more money, necessarily someone else has gotten less money. And if someone gets some sort of social advancement, necessarily someone else has suffered. So from their perspective, if you're talking about the values that are at stake, money, advancements, and so forth, there's kind of a fixed amount of that, whatever there is, and it can only be some people getting more and some people getting less. So what we have to do is then put two things together. One is about the nature of value and value creation, and the other is about the nature of the human beings that are engaging in this process. So we might then say, human beings are nasty, sinful, aggressive, right? And if we have that conception of human nature, then we're necessarily going to believe that human relations have to be zero sum, right? And the only way that you're going to get a positive sum understanding of social relations is by changing that understanding of human nature, that human beings are tabula rasa, or they have an inbuilt benevolence, and that leads them to get along with each other, and so human relations are social. But at the same time, you can focus only on the values that are created. So we take money or food, or so just take kind of basic material values. If we think those things are fixed, there's only so much to go around, then it doesn't really matter what kind of beings we are, whether we're naturally benevolent or naturally nasty, if there's only so much to go around, and so to speak, the demand exceeds the supply, then we are going to be forced into zero-sum relationships. And so very much people on the left who typically have a fixed view of values, particularly material values, they also then are forced into a zero-sum understanding of human beings. So the other issue here then is on the value side, rather than seeing values as fixed, to understand that values are created and that it's possible to create more value in the world so that, so to speak, the pie gets bigger. And if you can conceptualize the pie getting bigger, then you're going to ask not whom did you screw over to get your bigger amount, but what did you do to create more in the first place? So there's the two issues that have to be at work. Now, let me put it this way, in philosophical terms. If you put those two together, one of the things that makes Rand stand out is the way she's combining two radically modern theses about both of those. On the one side, you do have this long, I'm going to put it in quotation marks, conservative tradition that says you can't change human nature. So human nature is fixed, And but human nature is pretty nasty and negative. So if you think of a strong religious conservatism, human beings are sinful, bad creatures left to their pursue their own self-interest. They will engage in socially win-lose or socially destructive relationships. So what we need to do is teach people to suppress their self-interest, suppress themselves, not be interested in all of the things that are in their self-interest, like money and sex and so forth. Condemn those as greed, as nasty lust, and so forth, so that people will restrain themselves. And from that perspective, with that pessimistic understanding of human nature, only then can you get some sort of minimally positive social environment. People on the left, though, will want to say, we don't necessarily believe in that view of human nature. We think human beings are tabula rasa or just born neutral and malleable and so forth. The problem is, from the left perspective, that there's a fixed amount of stuff. And they don't have any understanding of entrepreneurism, of the creation of value that is possible. So from their perspective, even though they have a more neutral understanding of human nature, just the fact that some people have more than other people means that social life is necessarily about exploitation and alienation and thieving. And we have to hate rich people because they are the ones who are making poor people poor. So both of those have to be challenged. The idea that wealth is fixed and replaced by the idea that wealth is created by certain sorts of people, and the idea that human being nature is by nature nasty and sinful, instead that human beings can create their own character in a positive way and then become creators. So Rand's theory of selfishness, this is a very long answer to your question, then, is to say the relationship between the self and the others is not driven by deep conflict. It's not that human beings by nature are nasty, so they are in conflict, or that human beings are in this fixed zero-sum resource situation, and so social relationships have to be zero-sum. Instead, human beings can create their own character, develop their own minds, become creators, become entrepreneurs. That's good for them as individuals. But to the extent that we have a society in which many or most people are doing that, then we are creating a beneficial, mutually creating rich, wealthy, peaceful society.
Right. So it really gives you this optimistic vision, and yeah, you did encapsulate that. I think the relationship very nicely in drawing out the finer points of the distinctions, and the ways, of course, that they get represented in various ideological factions, whether that be extreme religious conservatism or socialism. And I wanted to ask you then, I guess this naturally kind of leads into my next point, which is about the influence of Ayn Rand's thought and philosophy on entrepreneurs, business, and especially your own, journey into business. You yourself are an entrepreneur, you're a businessman, you're engaged in a number of things in addition to your philosophical professional work. Unfortunately, for a lot of academics, even now, that is somewhat unusual. There is, I think, a growing cohort of academics who have recognized that there's a lot of usefulness to expanding their public persona, but not only doing interviews and more public publications like this, but also venturing, taking their expertise or taking their understanding of the world and finding ways to, for lack of a better term, monetize it in different ways. And so I wanted to ask you, was Ayn Rand's thought influential on your decision to go into business in addition to your professional academic work?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, kind of autobiographically. Yeah, the first part of what you were saying, I think, is right. It might be true to say that Rand's biggest influence has been on people who are going into business, entrepreneurs. And as I travel around and talk with people, you who are objectivists or not, don't think of themselves as objectivists, but just out doing living their lives, is Probably the biggest group of people who are inspired by Rand are people who've gone off, started their business, or done very well in the business world, and they will credit Rand with inspiring them and with giving them a set of intellectual tools, principled intellectual tools about business ethics to go out and do their business well. And they've been more successful, they think, than they otherwise would have been. Now, if you come to kind of inside the academic world, it's an interesting subculture, particularly in the 20th century academic world that I grew up in. I want to say that partly for philosophical reasons and partly for institutional reasons, Rand has had less traction there. Partly the philosophical reasons are that Rand is an advocate of reason. She had a strong empirical reason. She thinks that reason is competent. She's a great admirer of the the scientific project. But inside philosophy, philosophy's been in a more or less skeptical place in the 20th century. And so that approach to philosophy was just seen as a non-starter by many philosophical schools in the 20th century. I think things have opened up to some extent in this last generation, but I'm speaking a little more autobiographically now from the 20th century perspective. Also, it's true to say that inside the academic world, if you turn to the value and the political issues, there's been a lot more collectivism, socialism, in some cases outright admiration for the Soviet Union, communist China, a hatred of the United States, and so forth. So Rand, as a strong adversary of all things communistic and socialistic, and a great admirer of democratic, republican, free market capitalism, right? Whatever. Again, from inside the academic world, that was just seen as a philosophical non-starter. I think to come back to some of our earlier themes, if you look at the literary figures who were prominent, stepping a little bit outside of philosophy, but if you're going to be a well-read intellectual person, you read whom? You are supposed to read people like Tennessee Williams and Ernest Hemingway and Eliot, T.S. Eliot, and Fitzgerald. And all of these people are extraordinarily pessimistic and cynical, and their characters end up dying and just being miserable, committing suicide, becoming alcoholics, right, and so on. And so there's a very cynical, pessimistic view of life that is embedded in much of 20th century literature. So Rand's romanticism, and life as an adventure seems like this throwback to the 19th century, and just again very much out of fashion. Now that's to talk about the intellectual themes, but I think there's also a lot to be said about the psychological and sociological thesis about the nature of intellectual life in the 20th century. So a more institutional thesis. If you think about the kind of person who becomes an academic, this is the kind of person who's pretty smart, but also has been a pretty good student. And that to be a pretty good student through most of 20th century education meant you showed up on time in class, you sat at your desk, you prepared your homework, which is to say, you had read what you were assigned to read, you listened to the teacher, you took careful notes, and then on essays and tests, you just kind of repeated what the teacher told you and what was in the textbooks, and you got the right answer, right, so to speak. And then you did this for 12 years. And then you went immediately into university and you did it for 4 more years. Then you went to graduate school and you did it for another 4 to 6 or 8 years, however long it takes you to get your PhD, which is to say that by the time you are in your late 30s and into or late 20s and around 30, if you then are one of the lucky ones who gets a job and you become a junior professor, then you follow the template for getting published in the academic publishers. And you, in many cases, keep quiet and you don't really speak your mind if you have any unpopular opinions until you get tenure by the time you are in your middle 30s. Now, what psychologically are you as a person who has now become a tenured professor at college? Are you a rebel? Are you an entrepreneur? No, you're the opposite of that. So the idea of, I'm just going to quit my job and travel the world, or I'm just going to go off and start my own business. And I don't really care what the teacher says or what my professor says. And my goal in life is not security, to get a job at a university and get tenure and they can't fire me anymore, right? That's a completely different psychology if we stress it to the kind of psychology that Rand is celebrating in her novels, where you are completely independent artist. For example, Howard Roark gets kicked out of college, right, for sticking to his guns, so to speak. And many of her heroes are people who never went to college. They started businesses and did things in unconventional ways. So I think there is a kind of a psychosocial barrier between the way most academics think and the way most people in the real world or in the business world think. Now, then you come to me in particular. Yeah, I do want to say I think I am a little bit of an outlier in that respect, in that I did the academic thing for sure. Got the good grades and got the degrees and got tenure and published in the appropriate journals and so forth. But at the same time, I think partly my parenting, but then partially also my reading of Rand. I would also have to say reading people like Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman and lots of other market-friendly economists who are celebrating entrepreneurship and free market capitalism, that all of that also fed into my personal psychology. So, at various points, yes, I'm fine with starting my own research and teaching center and focusing on entrepreneurial issues at my institution, and combining that with what would be a traditional academic approach. And then, as you're also suggesting, seeing the new technologies and the new tools that come along, not as threats, but rather as tools that can make my career better, can make education better, and being willing to experiment and try with them. To come back to this social, the psychological and social things, one of the very interesting things about my career is that I have noticed every time there's been a new technology that comes along, going back to email in the 1980s and 1990s, and then online education and this, that, and the other thing, almost universally, the reaction of academics to every single one of these new technologies is, oh no, that's bad. That's a threat. I don't want to have to try it, partly an issue of having themselves to go up the learning curve, but also not seeing it as as a tool, the way entrepreneurs do, that could, in principle, make your business, which is education, better, or being willing to be experimental and try it out and do 15 different experiments to see what works or not. That instead, the academic world, this is a little bit overstated, but has to be dragged kicking and screaming up the technology, all up the technology curve. So that's a somewhat wandering answer to your big question there.
Well, thank you. That's a really interesting to just get your perspective on, especially the change from the 20th to the 21st century, and it's in particular the adoption of technology, the institutional pressures, the kind of selection for a certain kind of personality that happens in academia. I think unfortunately we're losing a lot more of the I guess stereotypical like eclectic professor personality because of the at this point, decades of compliance that are required to even get selected for these roles, which are also extremely rare to get.
Yes, and then if you add the not only the institutional rigidity, and the bureaucracy happens in the free market sector with corporate bureaucracies when they get big, and institutionalized happens in the government sector. Just the bureaucratic dynamic does in fact happen in the academic world, particularly since it emphasizes traditions and so forth. But if you add to all of that the ideological capture We call it postmodernism and the woke and all of the variations there that has occurred in the last generation or so. It's even worse. And then, as you suggest, that does select for a certain type of personality as well.
So, I guess just to wrap up our discussion on Rand, it's been a great having you on, and you've done a really wonderful job of
Well, thanks.
explicating the nuanced points of the discussion and getting people who are going to be listening to this and watching it in the future, the right grounding for the kind of discussion that we're having, which I think is oddly unusual for these kind of interviews. I usually get people who don't want to take the time to, define terms and things like this. And when I think about it, it does create a problem, which is that you're not really sure if, in the case of both guests, but also the listeners themselves, whether any of us are actually talking about the same thing. And so that's very refreshing, to sort of give an exercise in kind of a more Socratic way of approaching this kind of discussion. That being said, for those who are maybe less familiar with Rand, who maybe have only read one of her works or haven't read any of her either fictional or philosophical work, how would you suggest approaching Ayn Rand from the beginning?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. We mentioned earlier about Rand's influence, and we went to the business world and entrepreneurs and people, especially in the entrepreneurial tech sector. There's been a huge influence there. Most of those people will say that they read Atlas Shrugged, which really is just an astonishingly great novel. I think everybody should read that as well, as having been a huge influence on them. So I would say, put Atlas Shrugged on your bookshelf and take it off your bookshelf and read it at some point. The other huge influential sectors, I do some work in the philosophy of art and in the intellectual history of art, is the astonishing number of artists who will say that they read Ayn Rand's The Fountainhead first and found that extraordinarily inspiring. And that makes perfectly good sense because the main character there is an architect, but an artistic architect who is a trailblazer and has his own mind, but then is running into obstacles from all sorts of people who are conformist or traditionalist or various other reasons they don't like that approach. And so he is a person of great independence in his personal life, in his artistic vision, and a great deal of integrity. And I think the kind of person who is genuinely attracted to a creative field, who perhaps wants to be an artist, they find that enormously energizing. So I would say The Fountainhead also could be a very good starting point. And what I found is that people who are strongly attracted to Rand over the course of years, it really depends which one they read first. So it's kind of like, the first girl you kiss, you never forget that, right? Or the first boy you kiss, whatever the first kissing is, and that makes a huge impact upon you. So I always like to say, start with the fiction, either of those, and then follow your nose, depending on what your interests are, going into the nonfiction. If you're interested in moral issues or political issues or aesthetic issues, or epistemological issues, deeper issues in philosophy, pursue objectivism in those directions.
All right. Well, Professor Hicks, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful purview of Ayn Rand, her influence, her philosophy, her impact on you personally. I really appreciate you coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. Really good questions, Alex. Enjoyed the interchange.